Hey everybody, welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of April 2nd, 2021. I'm Charles Hain, writer for No Film School. I'm here with editor-in-chief of No Film School, George Edelman.
Hello.
And filmmaker Kath Tolentino.
Hello.
This week we are talking about Ray Fisher's continued demands for Warner Brothers to release the investigation around Justice League. We are going to be talking about personality types for directing. And if you have to be a big spirited extrovert to be a director, we've got two bits of tech news that I think are good this week. All that and a sort of tech nerdy ask No Film School this week on the No Film School podcast. All right. So the first thing, Ray Fisher. So we, you know, the Snyder Cut has been much discussed, but another part of the Justice League drama is that Ray Fisher has accused Joss Whedon of inappropriate behavior, not sexual in nature, I don't believe, but just like being a total screaming asshole to everyone when he took over for Zack Snyder on the original Justice League, and has been very public about it and has demanded an investigation. Warner's did an investigation, said we found that there was no racism involved, but has not released the investigation's results. So Ray Fisher has been very vocal this week of saying, just release the investigation. Like, let us make our decision about it, but release the investigation about how Whedon acted on the reshoots, what the work environment was like, how the decisions were made in the edit room that minimized my part and removing all Black and POC from the movie, release the report that goes into all that. This is like a... It's news in movie world, so we got to talk about it. It's such a complicated issue because on one level, like, you know, I work in academics. We have these things called Title IX investigations, which is where someone is accused of sex discrimination. It might be like sexual conduct in nature, or they might just be misogynistic, but like those reports are anonymous and the final results of the report are anonymous. And they're anonymous for a lot of reasons. They're anonymous to like protect everyone involved, including the victims. And it's really frustrating sometimes because like, you know, you will hear about a professor being fired and all you will hear is Title IX and that's it. And no one who knows anything is allowed to talk about it. And that is a good thing and a bad thing. We don't know anything about what's in this report. I understand why Ray Fisher wants the report out. I get that. That makes sense to me. And this isn't an academic environment. This is a professional environment, which should have different goals. Like these are all working adults. These are all people working in a multi-million dollar production. I get why he wants the results of the report known. Also, because like, why would anyone ever trust a summary of the report? Like that came up all the time in the Trump era, right? Where like Robert Barr would be like, well, my summary of the report is we did nothing wrong. And then like 4 months later, the actual report comes out and it's like, actually, they're a bunch of criminal nut jobs. And Robert, you know, like summarizing a report is always dangerous. But the other flip side of this is like, this is a ballsy move that I have a lot of respect for because, you know, I've been doing this interview process where I've talked to a lot of like people in the industry from the 60s and 70s and people burn bridges. And like, I'm glad that Ray Fisher is out there willing to be like, fuck it. I don't care. This was some bullshit. And I don't care if this hurts my job prospects in the future. And I have a lot of respect for that. And I've interviewed a lot of like old Hollywood folks from the 60s and 70s who are like, absolutely. It was harder to get movies made because of battles I fought with the studio. And I'm glad I did it anyway. And I don't know much about his acting work outside of this. He was in the third season of True Detective, you know, hopefully this does not affect his career, but I respect the fact that he doesn't seem to give a shit if it affects his career. He just wants the truth to come out. And I think that's baller as fuck.
I actually just had a question because I'm a little less familiar with this story. Does he have access to see the report himself?
Doesn't seem to be the case. What he said was prior to Justice League reshoots, racially discriminatory conversations were had on multiple occasions by Warner Brothers. He calls out some names. He says he wasn't aware until the summer of 2020 who was in the meetings, but he would have addressed in real time had he. The quote that he put out there that is the quote of the thing is, studio executive Geoff Johns saying, we can't have an angry black man at the center of this movie. And then the executives using their power to reduce and remove all black people from the movie. The rest of it sort of goes on to into some of the switching from Snyder to Joss Whedon, and just Joss Whedon, who he is in general, not a great guy by any stretch. But I think that the crux of it is that the character of Cyborg that Ray Fisher plays was central to this story. He could have arguably been the protagonist, the heart of the story, in the Snyder version, and in the process of switching to the Whedon version, the theatrical release, he was minimized, eliminated. There's a lot more to it, but that there were these conversations about that centering around his being black is the core of what Ray Fisher was talking about.
But also that Whedon was a jackass on set.
That is also part of it. Yes.
It reminds me of a recent story that I feel like did not make the headlines that I was very surprised about, which was an actor, Leonard Roberts, who was on the show Heroes way back when and was meant to be a main character of that show. And then over the course of filming the first season was like basically like killed off, and like his role was reduced significantly, and always people coming to him saying, you know, putting on a good face and giving him all sorts of reasons why. But ultimately he wrote in this article on Variety, it was because his white co-star seemed to be very uncomfortable, basically racist, and didn't want to play opposite him. And it really brings up this question of like, how, you know, what's the best way to make real change happen. He wrote this article, Leonard Roberts wrote this article on Variety. I don't feel like anyone was talking about it. And, you know, there's like using your own voice. There's the public putting pressure on these studios to do better. There's these internal reviews that are happening. You know, like what? How do we actually create a better working environment, a non-racist, non-misogynistic working environment?
You're talking about what comes next or what people can do to create change, which is certainly the ultimate like point of all this and where we should land. But just looking back again at this particular instance, there are a few things that we've talked about on the podcast here, but that are topics just in our, in this community and in the world at large these days that this brings up. One is, because Charles, you touched on it, the idea of the consequences for what you are willing to say. And where you're, what you're willing to fight over. There's a couple parallels to Star Wars, also Disney this is not Marvel, this is DC, so it's Warner Brothers. Star Wars is Disney. But anyway, there's a parallel, which is that one of the stars of the sequel franchise of Star Wars movies was black, and he was upset about the way he felt his character was minimized. He went public with that. And Disney sort of went a different, they decided to talk to him about it. I don't know. I don't have all the details on where that thread led ultimately, but he was very comfortable being outspoken about, I think that they minimized my character and took away a love story and did X, Y, and Z because I'm black. There was also the issue of, is her name Kelly Marie Tran? She starred in one of the Disney movies and then was basically reverted to like a non-role in the Disney Star Wars movies, which was another issue, also perhaps about backlash. And then the other thing that I'm bringing up is we've talked extensively about it in weeks prior, for those who aren't listening every week, about Gina Carano. We were talking about how she was fired from Mandalorian for blah, 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 all the things she shared and then not being appropriate. And we talked about consequences. So this, I just bring it up as a counterpoint because this is an instance where it's very possible that Ray Fisher will suffer some consequences in terms of work because he's outspoken about this. And it's I'm not saying he should. I don't think he should at all, but he may. And you said, Charles, the idea of being willing to burn bridges to take a stance on something. There is a historic precedent in the industry and everywhere of people saying, this matters to me. And I don't care if it makes it a little harder for me to earn a paycheck doing X job. And when we talk about cancel culture, which is a phrase I don't like to use, and Gina Carano, there's this sense of, well, but it's freedom of speech. She should be able to, well, she should be able to say whatever she wants. And she is. And there are consequences. And it comes back to this is like Ray Fisher is saying whatever he wants. It is arguably from a different side of the political spectrum than what Gina Carano was talking about. But without getting into the details on that, he will suffer any consequences that come from it as well. And that's why I just want to bring that up, because this is an industry where you never know who you're going to work with next. You never know what's going to impact your whatever. And if you're going out on a limb and saying things that may be unpopular but matter to you, then be bold and be brave and accept that it may mean that people won't work with you. Who knows?
I think that's a really interesting point. I think there's a way of reframing this, because it's not necessarily a matter of suffering the consequences. It's a matter of coming out and saying, I refuse to work in an environment that does not see me or respect me. And if I'm going to give my talents and my skill and my labor to this, I want to be in an environment that is inclusive and healthy and respectful of me and my time. And so by, you know, putting yourself out there and saying, this is what I need and this is what people like me need, essentially you're then laying some groundwork for more people to come out and start saying what they need too. And so it takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm glad he did it. And I'm glad John Boyega did it. The way that executives speak behind closed doors about things should not go undiscussed, unrevealed, especially if it comes out that it's in any way like of this nature. And similarly, the behavior of Joss Whedon on set and in general and in the past, we should have absolute zero tolerance for any of that. I feel very strongly about it. I just think there's no place for it in society anywhere.
Yeah, there's no excuse of like, well, that's just the film industry, and get used to working with difficult people has been used to excuse like absolutely atrocious behavior for way too long. I mean, I think, you know, we can also put a positive spin on it of like, at a certain point, you just make the decision of like, I don't want to work with assholes. So like, if talking about this costs me working with you, then you're an asshole and I don't want to work with you. So totally. I think that that's like kind of awesome. And I have a lot of respect for it. I also think that like, I doubt Warner's will ever release the investigation, because even if they read it 15 times and it seems to cover them, there's always a fear when you release anything like that, that there's something you didn't notice in it that will somehow bite you in the ass now or later. So it's better to just keep it under wraps. Their lawyers are telling them to keep it under wraps. And I'm sure there's reasons to keep it under wraps that like might also protect other, you know, might also be good reasons. I don't know what's in it. But we have texts. We like, one of the interesting side effects of the Snyder Cut getting released is the Snyder Cut shows, you know, Cyborg having a more pivotal, almost protagonist level involvement in the plot and then disappearing in the Whedon cut. And like, that is evidence. Like, there's no court of law that adjudicates these. I mean, maybe there is. Maybe there would be a court of law where it's like, jurors, you have to watch the Whedon cut and the Snyder cut over the weekend while you're sequestered. And we will talk about, like, maybe that will end up in a court case. I don't know. That would be fascinating if it did. But like, when, like, editing a movie is an iterative process in which you are constantly, you know, editing doesn't just happen when you're sitting at the editing machine staring at the footage. Editing happens, you know, at lunch when you're talking about it, or over the weekend, or in these meetings, or like, editing happens when you're on a conference call with executives or network notes. Like, that is also part of the edit process. And for a character to go from being prominent in an edit to less prominent in an edit, like, yeah, someone had to physically go in and to the media composer and cut those shots. But bigger than that, like, you're always talking about these things. You're always like, I feel like we're leaning too hard on this character, or I feel like it's dragging in this part, or I feel like it's like, somebody had to say, you know, less Cyborg. I feel like it's too Cyborg heavy. And like, that's something we need to be conscious of. Like, you know, if like, since they have documented, you know, since he says, I heard an executive say, I don't want an angry black man at the center of my movie, like, that is indicative of some bias. And as we have these editorial conversations, we should be conscious of our biases.
That's real. I have a lot of respect for actors in that they have to surrender themselves completely and put a lot of trust in these people who are asking them to, you know, bear themselves emotionally and sometimes physically on camera with no sense of like how it's going to turn out in the end. And I think about that, you know, when I've made movies in the past and I've included certain scenes or certain characters or cut out certain scenes or certain character, there's so many reasons for doing that. And I do feel for the actors when they see it and they're like, what happened to my favorite scene? And I have to tell them, I'm so sorry, for reasons that have nothing to do with you, it's gone. And it can really, that's got to be so tough as an actor to put your heart and soul into something and then just have other people, you know, put it on the cutting room floor.
This is also the tricky part of like, I love the idea of your court of law about the two cuts, but it's so hard to know what the reasoning was. They could claim, as you know, I don't need to explain this, but they could claim like, well, we just changed our mind about the performance or about the way the story worked, or it wasn't because of, you know, him being an angry black man or whatever. And like, that's all, you know, that we know what we know because of what we heard from him. We'll believe what we all believe. But, you know, one thing that's interesting is that, sorry, what year did Black Panther come out? Because I'm kind of curious what the timeline was with some of the other things that have happened in the general, like in the space. You know, there's been an expansion and some success in actually saying like, why don't we make a superhero who does, like, why don't we feature the superhero who existed, a superhero who looks a little different than the ones we've been doing over and over and over again for years, and see how that goes. And wow, it went really well. Interesting. Because Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think that's how you pronounce his name, right? He is working on a new Superman movie for Warner Brothers, which is likely to feature a black Superman. And he was pivotal in the creation of the Black Panther story. And that, or the Black Panther film story that we're familiar with. So there are these kind of movements in this direction. They only happen if people make a point about when we're still kind of backwards on it. But it's a good sign, I think, that that there is that kind of attention going forward, and that you can do things like, say, just be like, hey, let's do a Superman. He doesn't have to be a white guy. You know, we can change that.
All right. And then the next big story this week is a director named David S. Sandberg, who's directed a lot of great films. If you haven't seen the new Shazam, it is one of my favorite superhero movies. It was really quite solid. And he also makes like a lot of tutorial content, might not be the right word for it, but like, you know, he makes videos and stuff for the internet where he shares how he does storytelling. And his newest one is Can You Be an Introverted Director? And
his YouTube channel is awesome. We post a lot of it on No Film School and write it up, but he's great. And I believe the channel is called, just to give him a plug, Pony Smasher.
Oh.
So follow.
Love it.
That makes sense. Pony Smasher. So, the thing he's talking about in the video and that we then end up talking about in the article is like, there is this concept of like the directorial personality. That's like extroverted and dominant and like all tied up in all sorts of, you know, toxic traits and whatnot. He doesn't get into the toxicity, but he does talk about like, if you feel introverted, here are some things you can do. Like, he considers himself an introvert and he directs big studio movies that are good. So you can do it. Like, there is not one personality that you have to have in order to direct. Now, there are things that might be the same way, like, if you're an extrovert, some of the tools of directing are going to be hard for you. Like, sitting quietly and watching people for hours at a time to learn about human behavior might be harder for you if you are an extrovert. So, like, I do want to, like, I feel like whenever this introversion, extroversion thing comes up, it's always, like, lessons to make an introvert more extroverted. But, like, you don't see enough lists of, like, extroverts, how to shut up and be quiet more. But, like, that's also just as useful. And I say this as someone who probably counts as an extrovert, that, like, sitting quietly and observing things is a useful directorial skill that the extroverted director should practice. as an introverted director, he talks about like preparing a pitch or a meeting by pitching your family and friends. And frankly, that's good advice for everybody. I remember so clearly the first couple of years out of film school, like anytime any of us would have a pitch the night before, we'd get on the phone with each other and pitch to each other and give each other notes and feedback. And like anytime anybody was going into a meeting, we wanted people to feel like they were prepared. And I think that's an amazing piece of advice, whether you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert, is to like, you know, you can run through it and give yourself sort of the space to feel comfortable. Because like even the terms introvert and extrovert are sort of different situations bring out different things in different people. And like I've seen people who are like quote unquote introverted, but like when they're uncomfortable with a group of three or four people they feel safe with are like totally telling 50 jokes. So like I think the trick is making yourself feel confident and prepared to walk into the situation so that you feel like you are putting your best foot forward for a pitch.
I totally agree with you that the whole introvert extrovert thing, and like I gotta say, Myers-Briggs in general, like it's never resonated with me. I definitely
it's feel all eugenics.
Like... is that fact?
It's not fact, but that's how I think about it. I'm like, by the time we're in high school, haven't we all accepted that personality is mutable? And when you're in a good mood, you're in one way, and you're a bad mood, you're another way, and different people make you act differently, and like. Like there's no fixed thing where like it's born and you're like an introvert and have feelings and like that's your whole life. Like it just doesn't make any sense to me.
I know. Don't even get me started on horoscopes. I can't. But anyway, I definitely feel like I'm both. But I do think that there's something to be said for, you know, there's no one right way to be a director. I remember my first day of film school. One of our professors said, okay, as a director, the most important thing is you need to have an answer to every single question. You need to know exactly. Yeah, I know. I was surprised too. I was like,
that's insane.
I don't think that's true. But he's like, everything from like, what color is the car to where are you going to park the trucks to like, you know, where do you want the actor to stand? Like, people are going to be coming to you with questions and you have to have an answer and you have to be authoritative. And I fundamentally disagree with that. And I, as someone who thinks that auteur theory is a bunch of bullshit, really filmmaking is a collaborative effort. And it's all about, to me, you know, good filmmaking and good like team leadership is really about inviting collaboration and knowing how to help people on your team shine in their own way and creating a space where people can bring ideas. And so there is no one right way to be a director. And however you are as a person, like whatever your gifts are as a human being are going to be your gifts in the films that you make as well.
Bam. Damn. Yes.
I think this is an interesting question, and it's one that people grapple with and trying to figure out like personality traits you have that will work well in certain situations or for certain roles. And, you know, being a director is kind of like the thing a lot of people get into making movies. They're like, I want to be a director. One thing we mention in our, you mentioned the pitch and we mentioned the pitch in the article about it. And there's a lot of stuff about pitching, but I've met extremely successful people in this industry who are very introverted. And I've known some who are very extroverted. And I don't think it makes you necessarily good at pitching or bad. And one way of breaking down the difference between an introvert and an extrovert that I like, because it makes sense to me, and it's not just like who likes being around people and who doesn't. It was something where someone said an introvert is somebody who kind of it's taxing for them to be around people, but they can do it. But it requires them to produce a lot of energy. Whereas an extrovert is somebody who like feeds off of the energy of being around a lot of people, and it's not taxing. It's the opposite. And I thought, oh, that makes sense, because it's not that you can't do it. Don't ever let people say like, based on your personality or anything, you're going to be good at this, or you can do that, or you can't do that. I think that's the eugenics-y part of it, Charles, is that it's like, is it limiting your potential? I think the only like, it's funny the first that when you said, Kat, the thing about what makes you to be a good director, you have to do X, Y, Z. And I started thinking like sometimes people will say to be a leader, you have to be this way. This is how you lead. Or this is how I remember one job, somebody telling me that my flaw was I was too nice. And I really took that to heart.
Story of my life.
Someone told me, you're just too nice. You got to crack the whip sometimes. And I thought about that and I was like, nah, I don't think so. I think I'd rather be too nice and whatever comes, comes, than be a dick under any circumstance. I don't see the advantage. If you have to live with yourself at the end of the day, you have to go home and be who you are and whatever, and, you know, address whatever your role in society. Like, the things we do on this earth are so momentary and infinitesimal and unimportant. How we behave, like if we're just a decent person or not, like, again, coming back to Joss Whedon, like, be a decent person. Like, I don't care how many movies you made or TV shows. Like, no one's going to remember in 200 years. Like, no one's going to care about Buffy. But be a nice person. Like, that to me is just like, I don't get why people who get into this industry, and this is coming from a guy who didn't have a lot of success in the industry, so that, you know, maybe listen to Joss Whedon and do be a not nice person. But if you want to be, if you want to approach this in a holistic life way, I just think you can't go wrong being nice to people, and you can definitely go wrong. And I think I've seen it a lot. The people who are jerks, they will end up reaping what they've sown. Joss Whedon is just another of many examples. It does come around eventually. You can only maintain that for so long before someone wants to topple you really bad because they have good reason to hate you. The opposite is true if you can always be a nice person. So that's my spiel on it. Like, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, just like, don't be a jerk.
Well, and it still just keeps going back to like, just don't pretend to be someone else. Just be who you are. And like, we have all of these ideas about like what something is supposed to look like. And that's usually like a straight white dude who's over 6 feet tall is like in charge of things or whatever the fuck. And it's like, you know, I honestly, I've worked with genuine assholes in the film industry. I also think I've worked with some people who are pretending to be assholes because they think that's what the job requires of them. And I feel like, I'm like, why are, like, they're like, and I'm like, why are you doing this? Because yeah, you've heard.
It's like you've been trained. Yeah,
exactly. It's like hurt people hurt people. It's like you had some boss who was an asshole, and now that you're the boss, you feel like it's your job to do the same in order to get what you want on this, like, you know, hour of episodic reality television no one will watch again in 2 years. And it's just bizarre.
Here's something on that note that I've heard. So many people I've interviewed at No Film School and other places who work in the industry for years and have successful careers. And one thing you hear a lot is that they say, you to get jobs and to keep jobs, you need to be somebody people want to be around. And ultimately, if you're not a nice person, it's going to be harder and harder. Your talent or your track record is going to have to outweigh that people might not want to be around you. And it does come around. And I think your point there is just like, you know, if there's no reason to pretend to put on airs to be difficult or come down hard on people, because that habit that you build will end up biting you, or people, maybe they won't want to work for you, or maybe they won't give you the best recommendation, or like, networking is so important. And if you're going to get hired on a show, if you're going to be in a writer's room, if you're going to get picked up on a crew over and over again, people want to have, they need to want to be around you. So how you behave when things go badly will quickly define that.
Well, this might be waiting too off topic, but I feel like the film industry, like we were talking about, kind of, you know, if you get into the wrong pool early on, you can get this impression that you have to be an asshole to move forward. And then people around you, you'll sort of attract more people like that. And you can kind of, you know, end up wading into this sort of like cesspool of toxicity where everyone around you is operating out of that same mode. And it's tough too.
They call them agencies.
It's tough too because I just put this out as a word of warning, like those of us who do our best to be nice can sometimes end up being stepped on.
Oh,
when,
yeah.
And when you get in those situations. I was just reading this article about Peter Lenkov, who was the showrunner or is the showrunner for a bunch of CBS shows, MacGyver and Hawaii Five-0 and Magnum PI and stuff. And, you know, it's another Hollywood story about a showrunner that's just like massively abusive to everyone around him and stuff. And just, you know, it's tough out there, man. It's really tough.
There's so many of those. And in many instances, they drive people away and it becomes harder and harder. Maybe they make a lot of money for a time, but it becomes harder and harder to maintain the work. They might just stop working because people don't want to deal with them anymore.
Also, think about how many times we've heard stories about people, and this ties back to the original introvert thing. We've read so many stories of people who had like 3 or 4 years in film and then were just treated so terribly. They were like, you know what? Peace. I don't need it. Yep. I'm going to go work in any other industry. And some of that also relates to like, oh, in order to do the thing I want to do, I have to pretend to be what? Like, I have to pretend to be an extrovert if I want to be a director. Like, I just want to tell stories with moving images. Like, why do I have to put on the show in order to do that? Like, I'm not an actor. Like, why can't I just be me and direct a movie? And I think, you know, I wonder a lot about all of the people who've left this industry because of how limited the expectation of what it meant to be in this industry was for so long and how much work we still have to do to change that.
Well, there's also like filmmaking the art and then filmmaking the industry, like filmmaking the work. And there's so many different ways to make movies and to make movies that are near and dear to you and that will, you know, say what you want them to say. Whether or not they're accepted by Hollywood is a different question, sadly.
I have seen some very, what I thought were like extremely talented people who are just like, nah, I don't want to deal with that. And it's a bummer, but it's also like good for them because, if you don't have the stomach for it, like, why suffer?
But like, can't we just try and rebuild the industry from scratch so that it's not, so that those people are like, oh, this industry's great. I'm super talented and creative and I have a place here. Like, can't we do that? There's billions of dollars around. So can't we just figure it out?
I will say, this article that I was reading about Peter Lankov in the Vanity Fair had this amazing, amazing point that was like, particularly when it comes to like the people who are leading studios or the people who are running shows, so often they are creative people who have no management training, no leadership training, like don't come from that background. And then all of a sudden they're being asked to manage tens or hundreds of millions of dollars and big teams of people and like weekly delivery deadlines and just like massive amounts of stress. And there's no training for that at all. And there's no support, emotional or mental support at all.
Interesting.
And of course that's going to filter down. And of course that's going to create toxic environments. I feel like every other, you know, I currently work at an ad agency, which has much more of a like corporate kind of model. And we have like weekly check-ins with each other. And we have like, we talk about mental health and we have like, you know, like leadership development. I meet with my boss once a week to talk about the kinds of goals that I want to set for myself and how I'm feeling and stuff. And like that could totally be replicated in the film industry, but it's not something that people do or seem to know how to do.
I feel like there's this like mockery we all have, like as if we're still high school punk rockers that are like, corporate world is bullshit. And like corporate world is bullshit in many ways, but like there's also some corporate traditional stuff about like growing careers, being invested in someone's long-term career, like learning how to communicate with teams long-term that are actually like useful things that we should be stealing in the film industry.
So useful.
And
or like any industry, like they have actually weathered because a corporate, like there are so many things that a corporate environment has over a non-corporate environment, from just training people, caring about their success, taking like just all of that, like the idea that it's the drab cubicle life is sort of like Office Space, Fight Club era funny, but in practice they've had to hone and sand down and refine what it is and how to build culture and all these things that the gig world doesn't have, and that we should all strive to emulate. And yeah, if you're used to working on, like, there's sets and productions and production offices, there's nothing like that. It's way more of a wild, wild west, and not in a good way.
I'm gonna call myself out as a film professor and say that, like, you know, one of my biggest frustrations at USC was that USC was very much an old school film school that was like, we are not gonna, like, when we talk about the industry, we're gonna talk about, like, when you're dealing with a studio merger and you're like dealing with stock options. It was all this like high end level stuff. But like, no one ever talked about like how you do your taxes as a freelancer, or what 1099 means, or like what a small production company looks like. None of the stuff that was actually relevant to us was ever covered. There was one business class in my whole time at USC, and it was high level. Like, in 15 years, if you're a studio director, you'll care about this. And it's like, how many of us are going to end up getting there? Like, there's more US senators than there are studio directors. Like, give us real practical stuff. And I'm actually starting to realize that, like, and I've started integrating it this year, but I think we can do more, is that, like, as a teacher, I've always really covered a lot of that nuts and bolts business stuff. But I also think, like, collaboration and leadership stuff needs to also, like, film schools need to teach more than, like, the 3X story structure, but also, like, what leadership looks like.
I gotta say, I've said this before, and I feel like people can laugh me out of town, but as I was making my thesis film in film school, the best book that I read was Harvard Business School's like top 5 or top 10 articles about leadership. And like, more so than any book about story or cinematography, like more so, even more so than, like, I would say watching movies, although I'd watched a ton of movies already at that time. But anyway, that book really helped me in terms of just like knowing how to talk to my crew and how to not be an asshole and how to make a great movie that everyone could feel.
Well,
like
I have a couple writing assignments based on this for both of you now. For Charles, we'll do taxes for filmmakers or creatives.
Oh, totally. We'll do.
And business. And for Kath, we'll do leadership.
I'm down.
Leadership skills on set. Like, these are important things. That these are 100% what No Film School is about. So.
Love it.
Awesome.
I got to run, you guys. I'm sorry.
And now we're losing Kath and moving on to tech news.
Streamlining the post-production video editing process just got a whole lot easier with Spider Checker Video. It's a handy, portable tool designed to leverage how video is processed when working with vector scopes, waveform monitors, and editing software. Included is a patent-pending color pattern card that generates an easy-to-understand pattern of hues at 2 saturation levels, so you can see how all colors between primary and secondary colors are being captured. The result? You start off with more accurate color at the start of your video shoots, so you have less color editing to do later. Now you can save $20 off the purchase price of Datacolor Spider Checker Video. Just visit datacolor.com/NFS and enter code NFS at checkout. Offer is valid in US and Canada through 6/30/24.
All right, so we got 2 tech stories this week. One tech story, I'm just going to do them in whatever order, and hopefully George will have a lot of questions. So first tech story of the week, Sigma has come out with another iteration of their original FP. And if you remember the FP was a fun little camera that came out 2 years ago, shoots internal RAW, and they've done a refresh 2 years later, the Sigma FP-L. And what's fun about it is it's like the size of a deck of cards, so it's tiny. It's getting legitimately small, but it's still got a massive full-frame sensor. It uses the L mount, which is an open lens mount, also shared by Panasonic and Leica. And it shoots RAW, and it can shoot either to ProRes RAW or Blackmagic RAW. And off the top of my head, it's the only camera that will do either. Like, mostly it's either like, we can do Blackmagic RAW or we can do ProRes RAW. But this one does both, which I like. So it's like all about the open formats. It also does this crazy thing where, like, if you've ever done a multi-camera shoot, you know, usually the first thing you do at the beginning of the day is all the camera people get together, especially if you're like an indie person. What you'll do a lot of times is you'll be like, oh, I own a Sony A7S3 or whatever. And you'll call up a bunch of other people who own A7S3s and you all meet together to do the shoot. That's super common. I've been doing that since like the DVX100 days, where like 5 people I knew owned DVX100s. And every once in a while, we'd book a job where we'd all meet up and shoot multicam. And the first thing you do is you make sure everybody's menus are the same, because you don't want like one camera at 24 and one camera at 23.98, or one person shooting a Cinetone and the other shooting S-Log or whatever. And the Sigma FP will make a QR code on their little screen on the back that you show to the other cameras. And when the other cameras see that QR code, they will match settings, which is like, that's cool as shit. Every camera should do that shit. And so like, I'm excited about the Sigma FP because I think they're thinking about stuff in a fun way. Like as the original FP had it as well, the FPL still does it as a director's finder mode where like it will show you the frame lines of like, oh, you're shooting on an Arri Alexa LF. Here's exactly what the frame lines will be if you put the
that
lens
is
on
cool.
Here. It's not as cool. I want it to be cooler. The director's it's this fucking hedonic treadmill. Every time something gets better, we just want more. The director's viewfinder is sort of cool, but what it makes me want more. As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, you know what would be even better is if the camera magically knew what lens I was shooting with, which it could do with QR codes. I could put a QR code sticker on every lens I work with, and like then it could see what lens I was mounting. And so it knew the lens I mounted. And then it would record that in the metadata of the file. And I could make like Artemis style reports where I would have like a whole PDF of like, oh, I shot this on a 35 and this on a 50. There's no metadata right now, which means it just shoots a still photo, but it doesn't shoot a still photo that says what lens and focus I was on. And that's what I really want. I know I'm being ridiculous. I know Sigma gave me this like very cool feature that no one else has. And I'm like, whoa, now that I see that, I want more. It's like basically being a toddler. That's like, I didn't know chocolate milk was a thing. Can I have chocolate milk for every meal now? And Sigma's like, I should never have shown you chocolate milk. That's what Sigma is thinking right now.
Well, you say in your headline on the piece you wrote about it, the Sigma FPL is a camera that should influence the market. Is that part of your desire to see people take some of these things farther?
Yeah, I
in
mean,
what sense do you mean? What is the thesis? Can you
for
can
me?
You elaborate?
It's like I want everybody except Sony to use the L mount. Personally, I can forgive Sony for having E mount because they were so far ahead of everybody else that, like, of course, Sony, you get to have E mount. Great, good for you. You were like 6 years ahead of everybody else. But like Panasonic, Blackmagic, like Red, you guys should all just use L mount. It's the open format. And we're filmmakers. We love open formats. That's our thing. PV mount was used. It was invented by Arri, but it was used by Arri and Aton and MovieCam. And it was the open format, right? We like open format. It's great. Like that's our thing as filmmakers. So that I could have invested, like if it was the 90s and I bought a set of, you know, Zeiss Super Speeds, you know, like Series 3s, late 80s lenses. And I would have gotten them in PL mount and they would have worked with my 535. They would have worked with my Arri BL. They would have worked with my MovieCam Super America and then my MovieCam Compact if I kept buying a camera every 3 or 4 years. Like that open lens mount let me make better choices. So as a filmmaker, we should have open lens mount, like lens mounts that are open. So like I get why Nikon and Canon went with their own proprietary mounts, but like I wish, honestly, it would have been baller if Canon was like, you know what? We're going to do L. They wouldn't. It's not a Canon thing. And I get why Sony stuck with E. But like Blackmagic Red and Sigma, you know, should really take a note and be like, okay, L is this open mount and it's getting support. The lenses are good. They improved the autofocus with this one, which I think is good. They support, and this is actually something that the FP also supported, but we never wrote about it because it wasn't supported with the original when we did our first review. It supports both ProRes and Blackmagic RAW. And like, sure, if you're just a single owner operator, that doesn't matter because, you know, if your camera does ProRes RAW, you'll figure out a workflow. But like, if you're a freelancer, some companies are going to want one. Some companies are going to want others. Some jobs will fit one. And so the fact that it supports both is good. I wish more camera manufacturers would support both. The QR code thing is really sick.
Yeah, that seems cool too.
The one bummer is early reviews, and admittedly, all these early reviews are with a pre-production model. Early reviews are that the image, it's a new sensor, and it's like a crazy high-resolution sensor. It shoots like 9K stills. And apparently right now, the 9K stills, when you downsample them to 4K, don't look amazing right now. So the video quality is not significantly better than the original FP, which is a bummer. Which means that this is more probably targeted at still shooters, but it doesn't make any sense for still shooters because it's a weird still shooters are not obsessed with having the smallest, lightest thing ever because they don't need to put it on gimbals. They don't need to stabilize it. So It doesn't make sense for still shooters, and the video quality is not a big leap. There's a bunch of stuff in this that I want other people to be influenced by, and maybe the release version of the camera will have slightly better video quality. It remains to be seen.
Cool.
And then the other thing that's cool that came out this week is Aputure's Accent B7C bulbs. They're shipping in a kit form now. And the B7C bulbs we haven't talked about on the podcast, but they are Edison bulbs, which means the bottom is like that Edison screw plug that you can screw into the lamp in your apartment. And the reason why I like these is, you know, they're full. They are color mixing LED bulbs that can screw into lamps. And what is great about this is it means you can roll up to a shoot.
Yeah, I can already tell what's great about it.
Rebulb all of the practical lights and then control dimming and color with the Aputure Cetus Link app on your phone, which is actually a pretty good app. Like, apps are finally getting good. Godox has a good app. Aputure has a good app. The apps are getting better. And it's like, oh, wow, for $800, you can get an 8-light kit. So they're 100 a piece. But the 8-light kit is in like a case. The lights have a built-in battery. So obviously, most of the time, you won't be using the battery. But like, maybe you're on a stage and you don't want to have to run power to the lamp. Or maybe the power cord to the lamp is in shot and it looks ugly and the director's like, hey, can we just pull that power cord real quick? Well, having a 70-minute worth of battery in the B7C is kind of great because then you can just pull the cord but still have that lamp on. Like, you know, it goes from 2000 Kelvin to 10,000 Kelvin color temperature. Yeah, it's like, I don't know. It's super exciting that like for $100 a piece, we can be in the territory where we're getting like designed for motion picture light units that are ready to do the job we want them to do. Yes, you could get like a Philips Hue bulb for like $30 a piece. I have Philips Hue in my house. Philips Hue is great, but these are going to be brighter than those Philips Hues, which you might need if you're working with a whole lot of light on set for whatever reason. These are going to be more color accurate. They're going to give you more color flexibility than the Hue. Also, Cetus Link is eventually going to interact with DMX. So if you're lighting your whole stage DMX and you want your practicals on the DMX board, you can. There's workarounds to do it with Hue, but it's better. Like, this is going to be a better integration. I am super psyched.
This seems like such an obviously good thing to have access to, and I'm almost surprised that it doesn't exist already in form because, yeah, so many times on a smaller shoot, your gaffer, DP, everybody will roll up and there will be all kinds of things you want to do with light that you have to just deal with what you've got there. Smaller stuff, changing out bulbs, being able to change out a practical bulb with something that's just with an LED. That's so cool to me, at least.
Oh, yeah. And that it's $100 a bulb. So an 8-light kit's $800 is such a like a reasonable price point for something that will be so useful on so many shoots. Now, what I want, and I hope Aputure does this, but I don't care who does it. Somebody has to do this with like T6 fluorescents. Like I want to be able to go to a shopping, like a supermarket or anywhere really where there's fluorescents and I want to rebulb them with full RGB LEDs. That is apparently really hard because of most of those light units have ballasts that affects the power. So you have to build the bulb in a certain way that it takes the power that's gone through the ballast. Because, you know, I'm not going to go into a supermarket. Like usually when you see LED bulbs in a supermarket now, they went through and they changed out the fixtures and took out the fluorescent ballasts. However, no random supermarket that gives me permission to shoot is going to let me rebulb. And I don't want to pay the money to do it. So I want like a 4-foot T6 bulb that I can just like stick into any random supermarket and it works, but I get full RGB control. I want that so bad. And nobody makes it. I've even thought about trying to make it myself, but I don't want to learn how to make lights, but somebody's got to make that.
Yeah. Well, it's never too late to learn.
Yeah. I guess maybe I'll learn to make lights. I also promised I was going to learn deepfake tech. So I got a list. And then our last question this week, William Figg, great name, Mr. Figg. What are productions using for remote on location Wi-Fi? We've been using a hotspot, which I'm assuming is just like a hotspot from a phone, and we need a more robust solution. I liked this question because this is like a problem so many productions have is like you roll up on set and like 9 people are going to have laptops out like downloading media, but also like now we're starting to like we need to upload that media to Frame.io and like there's all this stuff that's happening on set that requires internet. But if you're out in the woods or you're out in the desert or you're out in a lot of places, like what do you do?
You know what my answer is?
What's your answer?
I have a real quick one.
Starbucks?
Just do with do without it. That's how we used to do it. I'm not so old that I was on sets before it existed. Like Wi-Fi existed in every set I've ever, every time, pretty much, I think. But you don't, you can probably function more without it than you think. But I can appreciate that there are situations where you absolutely cannot, like a few of the ones you just mentioned, where maybe there's somebody who needs to look at something on Frame.io, or maybe there's assets that need to come in or out through, you know. But I think you'd be surprised how much of a thing you can shoot without access to Wi-Fi.
I did not pick this Ask No Film School to get the George Edelman old man yells at cloud answer, but I am so happy that I picked this one and got the old man yells at cloud answer. I'm actually gonna go against that and say that here's the thing. Like the feature film I directed, we shot in the National Radio Quiet Zone, which, like, if you haven't been there, it's a wonderful place. Please don't go. There's nobody in it, and I don't want you to ruin it. But like, if you can go, it's amazing. It's a 50 square mile zone where there's no cell phones, because there can't be, because the government won't allow it, so that we can use satellites technically to look in space. I mean, we can use antennas to look at space, but also there's like an NSA facility and we spy on foreign governments with it. And it's amazing. There's no cell phones. It's great. Like, everybody was on set on time because you can't text running late. And so you actually are there on set, and like, people were reading newspapers on set when they weren't working. It was awesome. The one time someone was late, it was a huge deal, like it used to be in the 90s. I loved it.
Being late is unacceptable when there's no way to contact people.
I want to make every movie in the National Radio Quiet Zone. So yeah, there's tremendous stuff you can do without the internet. However, on that movie, the producers were there. I knew them. We were friends. There were no financiers. There were no other stakeholders. We shot the movie. We brought the drives back to LA. We transcoded it, and we started the edit old school style. However, the world is unfortunately changing, and with it, our expectations change. So the same way Sigma giving me the director's viewfinder mode made me want more, clients, stakeholders want more now. And nice, so like, tie-in. The expectation for, you know, like I did this job, or not a job, I did a spec thing in Vietnam a couple weeks ago. And like, I was watching live takes from Vietnam on Qtake, which was like amazing. I was like, you know, on my phone watching live takes, giving feedback on notes. It was a tabletop thing. It wasn't like acting thing, from Vietnam live. Like, so like, now I expect that. Now, like, there's so much more than there used to be that clients, stakeholders, other people expect. And especially with COVID, like, it used to be the client, like, we didn't need Wi-Fi in the 90s because we were in LA, and say you're working on a car job, the client's going to come, they're going to stay at Shutters, they're going to like have a great time in LA, it's all going to be expensed, and they're going to be on set all the time. And they're on set off, they're only needed about a third of the time, but they want to be able to make the company pay for them to stay at Shutters. So they come out for the whole time. And like, they're not going to do that anymore because of COVID. So they're going to be sitting in Detroit, but they're going to want to see what the takes are looking like. They're going to give notes and feedback. So the demand for it is different now than it used to be, both because of COVID and because client expectations have changed. So I'm not going to yell at a cloud. I'm going to say that there are solutions. So Teradek, who makes a wide variety of zero delay wireless video devices, the Teradek Serve is one of my favorites. Like, every time I show a new crew member the Teradek Serve, I've had one for 3 or 4 years now, and yet I still end up working with new people. I haven't worked with it, and I show it to them and they're like, oh, this is so cool. And it basically lets 10 iPhones on set turn into wireless video monitors. It's great. It's addictive. Once you've started working with Serve, it's really hard to go back. They make a nice toy called the Link. It's available in backpack form, Link Pro. And what it'll do is you can insert, like, you can go get cards from like Verizon or AT&T or wherever. And so you can like take 4 different Verizon signals and aggregate them together to 1 Wi-Fi signal. And then it's like a dedicated Wi-Fi hub. It's not like your phone being a hotspot, which is going to overheat and it's beyond the power. It's designed to do this. And so you can have like a backpack that has, it's the equivalent of taking 4 wireless signals, bonding them together, and then creating like a really nice, robust Wi-Fi network that all 9 of the laptops can go on, and the DIT can be uploading stuff to Frame.io and sending stuff out over Qtake and and, you know, the producer can be checking their Google Sheet budget, and all of that stuff can be happening. And it's a product. It's made by Teradek. Every once in a while, when we used to do videos at NAB, which, like, I don't know if that will ever happen again, we actually choose, and this is actually something you've dealt with, George, is we choose the hotel
for NAB we've talked based about this.
On Wi-Fi. So, like, even though you're like old man yelling at a cloud, you make a hotel decision because we want to get up all those videos as fast as we can. And so we pick the hotel with the best Wi-Fi in Vegas in order
but
to get all those.
We're not telling our secrets.
Yeah, we're not going to tell you which. Yes, I'm sure our competitors, whoever they are, listen to this, and we're not going to tell them which hotel we stay at, but that's why it's picked. And every year, I'm not a big fan of that hotel, so every year I'm like, guys, why don't we just ask Teradek to loan us a link for the week, and then we can
talked
get
about the link many times, you and I. Yes,
and then
as
we
soon
could
as you brought
stay
it up, I was like, oh yeah,
in another hotel that doesn't that smell nice. Like cigarettes. You see, and
although it's Vegas, so. But
they
yes,
mostly
they do
smell
exist.
Like cigarettes. Yeah. I knew releasing that I might be revealing a trade secret of which hotel we stay in. But
I don't think it's
that's
a
like
trade
half
secret.
The toads.
Yeah. I think that information is available to everyone. But I would, I mean, if you want to do the digging, it's funny because you brought it up, and I was like, I immediately started thinking about NAB and why we do that and how important it is. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, totally dependent on what you are shooting and what the demands are, how critical Wi-Fi could be.
And I forgot to list in the stakeholders, like, it's not just clients, it's also like fans. Like, the people who watch No Film School's NAB content would like it to appear the day of NAB. They're not expecting to watch
that's a great example of shooting something where it's like delay to getting it up means like what? It's, you know, people not seeing it when they care about it and finding out about it some other way. And they want to watch that information. They want to see what's happening on the floor. It would be nice to go back to NAB, wouldn't it? Or to go anywhere, really. But
I don't expect to be at NAB until 2023.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed that one day. But in the meantime, I mean, you could be shooting something where you absolutely need to have access to the internet, and it has to be good. And that's why those solutions exist. But you could be shooting something where you don't. And if you're in those circumstances, I think it's worth considering for a variety of reasons what it would be like to have a set. I just have this fantasy now, and I'm on an old man cloud rant of sets, like, you know how there's these directors who have these weird rules, and we talked about people being jerks or not being jerks on set, but here's a good potential being jerk one. It's like, no internet, no phones, no Wi-Fi, no, like, and it's all, you know, old school. I just wonder what level. I'm not anti people doing stuff on their phones. I mean, that's how we do so much of our work. But I wonder to what extent people dial in differently to the other things they're doing. Like, you know, could be interesting to note.
You've got to do a movie in the Radio Quiet Zone. You'd love it. It's great. I highly recommend it. Everyone, it's a really West Virginia, man. It's great. All right, I'm going to plug my pluggables. You can check me out on the internet at Charles Hain and on Twitter at Charles Hain. I'm going to be doing a WeFunder soon for a project, so you're going to hear me pitching my WeFunder for a while. That's a online platform, so if you're like, oh, that Charles Hain, he does good stuff, you should check out WeFunder, which is not even up yet, but I'm like priming you for later in the like hypnosis stage of sales. But I'm telling you I'm doing it, so that makes it maybe less reprehensible. Anyway, charleshain.com. Check it out.
I'm George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School. You can find all the stories we talked about today and more at nofilmschool.com. Follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. Like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast. And send us questions at ask@nofilmschool.com. We love to hear from you. Charles, you mentioned WeFunder. We have written about WeFunder, and we've had other filmmakers through No Film School, through our No Film School community, work with WeFunder. It's really cool. I just want to take the chance to plug it and tell people about it. We have a post that actually this guy George Edelman wrote called, "Is This the Future of Indie Film Finance?" And I think it's awesome. I think more people should look at it as an option, and I'm very curious to track what you do with it.
Awesome. Alrighty, well, we will talk more about that in the future episode when I've launched the thing. Alrighty, folks, I will see everybody next week. Have fun making movies.